This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 21st, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Aura Bogado. Coming up in today's newscast, lawmakers continue to investigate malfeasance in the U.S. Justice Department. The U.K. and Poland threaten to veto the new EU treaty if their demands aren't met. And Australia's Indigenous community responds to the acquittal of a police officer charged with the death of an Aboriginal in custody. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced plans to revise rules regarding smog levels. The announcement comes after agency studies indicated that current standards are too lax to sufficiently protect public health. The public has 90 days to comment. Some environmentalists have criticized opening the rule change to public comment, saying that it leaves open the possibility for maintaining a status quo that the government's own data has found to be unhealthy. Representatives Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania and Lee Terry of Nebraska have introduced legislation to create hundreds of low-power FM stations in urban areas across the U.S. LPFMs are non-commercial community radio stations with a limited broadcast range. Congress approved legislation in 2000 to allow the Federal Communications Commission to issue LPFM licenses. A rule change added to that bill limited the licenses to rural areas after large broadcasters raised concerns that the small stations would encroach on their signals. Government-funded studies have since proven otherwise. Independent music label owner Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls says large stations should not oppose the LPFM legislation for fear of losing their market share.
I think it'll help the larger stations as well, because what's happening is people are just not listening to the radio as much as they should because they don't find anything there for them. And I think when they find it to be a source of community information again and a source of a diversity of voices and they can hear themselves in that source, then they will start listening again and it will protect radio for the future and help keep it healthy.
Senators Maria Cantwell and John McCain have introduced a companion bill in the upper house of Congress. The Local Community Radio Act of 2007 will allow the FCC to expand LPFM licenses to cities and towns. Washington's chief envoy for North Korean nuclear disarmament talks made an unannounced visit to Pyongyang just days before UN monitors are due to return. FSRN's Jason Strother has an update from Seoul.
Throughout his tour of East Asia, Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill stressed the need to restart stalled nuclear talks. Officials here in Seoul are calling the envoy's surprise trip to Pyongyang a great effort to build mutual trust. It's the first time in 5 years that a high-ranking U.S. figure has paid a visit to the reclusive state. Progress in the nuclear row seemed to have been made following the resolution of a $25 million banking dispute last week. The North even invited inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency to return as part of a disarmament agreement made earlier this year. Hill's expected to stay only one night in North Korea before returning to Seoul. The Undersecretary of State has said that six-nation negotiations could get back underway next month. For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
15 people have been killed at an oil platform in Nigeria's Niger Delta region after the military carried out an operation to rescue oil workers held hostage at the platform. Samuel Okoye reports from Lagos.
The Nigerian military said 12 suspected militants, two civilians and a soldier, died in the operation to recover an oil platform owned by the Italian oil company, AGIP. A militant group in the region took over the facility on Sunday and had held 28 people hostage ever since. Most of the hostages were oil workers. The militants said their occupation of the facility was in response to the killing last week of 8 local people by soldiers guiding the oil platform. Violence has been on the rise in the Niger Delta as local militants, angry at the disproportionate distribution of wealth in the oil-rich region, intensify their campaign against private foreign oil companies. Nigeria's new president, Umaru Yar'Adua, says one of his priorities is to peacefully end the crisis in the Niger Delta, but the use of military force to secure the oil platform may only escalate the situation. This is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
An indefinite dusk to dawn curfew will go into force in the Somali capital Mogadishu starting Friday night. Abdurrahman Warsame has more.
Somalia's National Security Commission announced today that a curfew will take effect in Mogadishu from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. starting this Friday night. Anyone seen on the streets will be subject to arrest. The aim of the curfew is to curb growing insurgent activity. A recent upsurge in bombings has killed civilians, Somali security forces and foreign troops, and gun battles are a daily occurrence. Regardless, many people in the capital say that the curfew is too restrictive and will prevent Muslims from attending obligatory late evening and early morning prayers. Officials did not say how long the curfew will remain in effect. For FSRN, I'm Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
On both sides of the Capitol building today, Senate and House committees questioned the Department of Justice under Alberto Gonzalez. The House revisited the firings of U.S. attorneys, where Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty maintained he had little knowledge of the plan. Meanwhile, a Senate panel questioned the alleged politicization of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
This is the second time Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty testified before Congress on his role in the firings of nine U.S. attorneys. He was brought back because White House liaison Monica Goodling, in her testimony before Congress, said McNulty was not completely honest in his statements. Lawmakers wanted to question him on that accusation, and McNulty wanted to defend himself. Chair of the Judiciary Committee on Commercial and Administrative Law, Linda Sanchez.
I'm curious in getting your response to Ms. Goodling's statement that your Senate testimony was knowingly incomplete.
I believe my testimony was dead on accurate in what I knew at the time, that the White House had approved the names, and that's how I responded.
As in his testimony in March, McNulty, number two at the Department of Justice, maintains he found out about the White House's involvement 11 days before the dismissals in December of 2006. He found out the White House approved the names during a meeting with Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. McNulty also maintained his ignorance of the plan to fire the attorneys until Gonzalez's chief of staff, Kyle Sampson, informed him in late October.
The information I provided to you in my day-long interview and the information you see in the emails explains, and perhaps most importantly, what the Attorney General said in his testimony and what Kyle Sampson said in his testimony explains that I was consulted in this process at the end of what we now know to be the process. That is, there was a process that's extended over a two-year period of time looking at different U.S. attorneys.
McNulty said he raised some objections with the list of dismissals. One U.S. attorney was taken off the list because of McNulty's concerns. McNulty admitted he didn't pursue other objections he had, partly because he said he was soft, a weakness he revealed during a question-and-answer session with Judiciary Committee staff at the end of March. Representative William Delahunt, Democrat of Massachusetts.
The Deputy Attorney General is the direct supervisor of the U.S. attorneys, and yet you weren't part of the process.
And to be fair, I mean, Mr. Sampson might say that, you know, he talked to me about U.S. attorneys over the course of my time that year I served as deputy, and we talked
but
about
But you were not involved in the compilation.
I wasn't aware of a specific process of identifying U.S. attorneys.
McNulty has submitted his resignation to the Justice Department. On the other side of the Capitol grounds, the Senate Judiciary Committee inquired about allegations of politicization of the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ, ignoring cases of voter discrimination and hiring career attorneys only with conservative backgrounds, some charge. Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat of Maryland, said DOJ statistics show a shift in focus.
Record shows the division has filed almost as many cases alleging discrimination against whites than they have against African Americans or Latinos. Now, discrimination in any form is wrong, and we want the Department of Justice to speak out on behalf of every American in the form of discrimination. However, I think it is apparent that efforts to help racial minorities is where the Department of Justice must place its priorities. that concerns me.
Won Kim, Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division, said he prosecutes cases where he sees discrimination.
I don't think that I have placed disparate attention on cases involving any one racial minority. I don't think that's my job.
Congressional inquiries are ongoing. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Tensions between European nations are increasing as 27 leaders met this afternoon in Brussels to discuss a reformed European Union treaty. Germany holds the EU presidency until the end of June and is attempting to mediate and push through the reforms. But leaders of Poland and the UK continue to threaten vetoes if their demands aren't met. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
18 out of the 27 EU member states have already ratified the treaty, and four others have nearly ratified it. But the treaty cannot come into force until it's been ratified by all 27 EU member states. Markus Jochtenfuchs is professor of European and Global Governance at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin.
Well, we do not yet know how the new treaty looks like. We will only know it tomorrow evening. But what is currently being negotiated is mainly a difference in symbolism. That means that everything that makes it look like a constitution, such as the flag, such as the anthem, but also more substantive issues such as the Charter of Fundamental Rights, are most likely to be dropped.
The Charter of Fundamental Rights outlines a whole range of civil, political and social rights for EU citizens. But the UK is afraid that Germany's proposal to make this charter legally binding could allow the European Court to make decisions that would change British labour law. However, Germany has made some concessions in the reform paper by giving countries a chance to opt out of EU policies in the area of policing and criminal law. But German Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned of dire consequences if the treaty process fails. Some see this as a veiled threat to Poland, but other critics say the importance of an EU treaty depends on your point of view. Jan Teschau is head of European Studies at the German Council on Foreign Relations in Berlin.
You know, a dire consequence depends entirely on where you stand on Europe. Some people say that, you know, we can just very well live with what we have, and if this fails, it's not going to be a dire consequence at all. Others will say that, you know, we cannot live at all with what we have now because we've grown too big and we need to be more flexible, and the new constitution, or the treaty rather, would actually be would accommodate to that.
Britain, Poland and the Czech Republic say that Europe has got along well enough without a treaty. But Professor Jochtenfuchs from the Hertie School of Governance says that with European expansion, a reformed EU treaty is the best way forward.
Well, I think we should have a new treaty. I wouldn't call it constitution because the term constitution has been really the source of much protest, although it is not really linked to too much substance. But we definitely need something. We need something that gives the European Parliament more rights. We need streamlined decision-making procedures. We need more transparent legislative procedures. So we definitely would need it, yes.
Jan Teschau from the German Council on Foreign Relations.
No matter what you think of the EU and its workings and its technicalities, it's absolutely true that, you know, European nation states, if you take them one by one, are not able to actually deal with globalization and its challenges anymore. It's not possible. And so you need to find some way of working together. The EU is one form of doing that.
The negotiations over a new EU treaty continues in Brussels. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
As a humanitarian crisis grips residents in and out of the Gaza Strip, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert are scheduled to meet Sunday in Egypt. This will be the first meeting between the two since Hamas forcefully took control of Gaza. FSRN's Ghassan Banoura has more.
Though the two leaders are to meet, Abbas has ruled out talks with Hamas. The Palestinian president has called Hamas movement murderous terrorists after an alleged assassination attempt on his life and for carrying out a coup in Gaza Strip against the Palestinian Authority. Hamas has called Abbas's remarks disgusting, and thousands of Hamas's supporters denounced Abbas in the streets of Gaza on Thursday. In response to the president's charges, Dr. Khalil Abu Layla, a Hamas leader in Gaza.
This is a totally false accusation. If the Qassam brigades of Hamas activists wanted to assassinate Abbas, they could have easily done it.
United Nations issued a report on Wednesday stating that unless Israel allows supplies for basic needs to enter the Gaza Strip, the coastal region will run out of those supplies in 2 to 4 weeks. all commercial and border crossings leading in or out of the Gaza Strip have been closed by the Israeli army since last week when Hamas took control of the area. Senior Israeli officials told Israeli media on Wednesday that Israel plans to cut off all but humanitarian and basic supplies to the coastal strip, home to 1.5 million people. Today, thousands of people are still stranded at the Rafah crossing in the southern part of the coastal region. Most of them were reportedly in Egypt for medical treatment. Today, the Egyptian border police were trying to force them to go back to Egypt. Mohammed Al-Lubbas, one of the Palestinians stuck at the border.
We are roughly 3,000 people stuck here, men, women, elderly and children. We have no more money to stay. We desperately need to go back to Gaza. We have been here at the terminal for 51 days. There's no food or medicine. I'm sick. I was in Egypt for treatment, and when I came back, the terminal was closed. Egyptian police forcefully transported many of us back to Cairo, but the rest are hiding in the nearby farms.
Late Wednesday night, the Israeli army evacuated dozens of Palestinian Gaza residents to Egypt, who had spent days at a border crossing in the northern Gaza Strip. Israeli sources stated that some 25 Palestinians were still stuck at that crossing Thursday morning. A Palestinian man waiting to flee Gaza on Monday was killed and several were wounded when Israeli troops stationed on the northern Gaza-Israeli border shot at them. For Afasaran and IMEMC.org, from occupied Bethlehem, Palestine, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Ali Larijani, is scheduled to meet with the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, on Friday. This comes just weeks after a senior Iranian official canceled a meeting with the IAEA. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department announced this week that the U.S. and other United Nations Security Council members are at the very early stages of drafting a third U.N. resolution sanctioning Iran. FSRN's Saida Jamshidi reports on the possible ramifications of another round of sanctions.
Mohammad Borhan is an Iranian entrepreneur who manufactures steel-cutting machineries. In order to produce these machines, Borhan needs to purchase pipe from Iran's domestic market. His recent assignment has been with Iran's largest industrial corporation called Isfahan's Mubarake Steel Company.
In our meeting with the board members, we discussed the ways in which we needed to obtain our material for the job. They mentioned that the European countries or Far East countries like Japan wouldn't enter into any deal or business agreement with them. For that reason, many of the production lines have stopped.
To keep its product's final price low, Borhan says he needs to buy cheap pipe.
The pipe was 330,000 tumans per kilo, but I bought these pipes from China for 260,000 tumans. It is very interesting to see how many miles the materials have traveled from China and how much transportation fee or tax has been paid for them. But in the end, I purchased the Chinese products instead of the Iranian because it was cheaper. Iranian material cannot compete against the market because of the sanction.
Iran's domestic economy also suffers. Inflation has risen to 14%, its highest rate since 1970s, and Iran's currency, the rial, has dropped dramatically against regional currency. Economists argue the new government's mismanagement in recent years has put Iran into a more chaotic situation. For instance, a few days ago, the government decreased the banking interest rate to 12% from 14% overnight. For that reason, banks stopped giving away loans, and private banks are close to bankruptcy. Musa Ghani Nejad, a professor in banking and monetary policy in University of Tabatabai in Tehran, argues that government's mismanagement in directing money through the economy has made a catastrophe.
The government made the decision to fight against inflation last year. Unfortunately, their efforts increased the market liquidity by 40% and therefore increased inflation rate from 11 to 14%.
High inflation has influenced Iran's purchase power. Mansour B. Taraf is an Iranian economist who writes extensively about Iran's financial issues.
If further sanctions would impose against Iran, producing goods would decrease. When production goes down, per capita income decreases. And then when per capita income decreases, people would endure hardship weakening their purchase power.
Iranian political analysis considered the two-year-old government the most unprofessional government since the 1979 revolution. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's rhetoric against Israel, his handling of the nuclear dispute, and his domestic economic policy has weakened the conservative and pro-nuclear president at home. Due to the public outcry, the Iranian Majlis or parliament is discussing a bill to make this government's life shorter. Until then, imposing harsher sanctions against the Iranian government will have greater impact on Iran's already shaky economy. For FSRN, I'm Saeeda Jamshidi in Tehran.
Australian Prime Minister John Howard today announced a crackdown on remote indigenous communities, allegedly in response to a report on widespread sexual abuse of children. The government plans to limit welfare payments and override Northern Territory laws in order to ban alcohol and pornography. Meanwhile, many indigenous communities are reeling from this week's acquittal of Australian police officer Chris Hurley, the first officer to go to trial over the death of an Aboriginal person in custody. From Sydney, Erica Voles reports.
The manslaughter and assault trial of Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley began with a smoking ceremony and ended after 6 days of hearings. An all-white jury returned a verdict of not guilty on either count after just 3 hours and 45 minutes of deliberations. Chris Hurley admitted that in November 2004 he had caused the injuries of the deceased Morunji Dumunji, which included broken ribs and a liver that was almost split in two. But the jury accepted Hurley's claim that it was an accident caused by his falling on Dumunji as he struggled to bring him into custody for being drunk and disorderly. Morunji died in his cell half an hour after sustaining these injuries. Despite the deaths of 241 Indigenous people in police custody between 1990 and 2005, this is the first time a police officer has faced trial. This trial only took place after a public campaign brought pressure on the Queensland government to overturn an initial decision to dismiss the case without even trying it. Queensland Premier Peter Beattie responded to the verdict by calling for calm.
I would urge everybody to accept the decision of the court without question.
He ended up that he was...
You were trying to lift him?
He was down like that. He was down...
That's the voice of Chris Hurley from a police video filmed the day after Dumunji's death. This reenactment of events from Hurley's perspective formed a key part of the defence's case. But legal observers like solicitor Stuart Levitt, who campaigns for Indigenous legal rights, said other key pieces of evidence never saw the light of day.
The prosecution only presented about 70% of the evidence. Evidence that could have brought doubt on Hurley's credit concerning the way in which the police investigated the matter and the fact that he entertained the police investigating officers who were personal acquaintances of his or even friends at a barbecue at his home was never adduced.
Solicitor Stuart Levitt said bias against using Indigenous witnesses meant two Palm Islanders were never called to the stand. Meanwhile, Indigenous activist Gracelyn Smallwood said the Dumunji family and the Palm Island community were still coming to terms with the court's decision.
It's been very, very painful for them, and I've actually just left them, and they're in just feeling very, very saddened, but very quiet and very gentle.
She expressed dismay at Premier Beattie's calls for calm, while the police union, which fought the trial every step of the way, was preparing to air TV and radio ads expressing support for Senior Sergeant Hurley.
We have called for calm on the Aboriginal community, but how much more can the Aboriginal community as a nation take with the arrogance of the police union now putting out television and radio ads in support of Sergeant Hurley?
The Queensland Police Union failed to respond to our requests for an interview. While there will be no avenues for appeal due to the case being heard by a jury, lawyers representing the Dumunji family are looking at the feasibility of a civil lawsuit. Queensland Indigenous activist Sam Watson says the momentum created by the trial will be channeled into a National Day of Action in July.
So this is not a time to sit back and grieve in isolation. This is a time to come together and map a new way forward and try to change this legal environment in order to achieve real and solid justice.
For FSRN, this is Erica Vowles in Sydney.
Members of Congress are trying to shut down an American facility in which thousands of soldiers allegedly have been trained and gone on to violate human rights across Latin America. A vote to end the funding for the School of the Americas is expected to come up next week, and lawmakers are trying to gain enough support to close the camp for good. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
The School of the Americas has existed in different forms for over 50 years. Over 60,000 soldiers from South and Central America have been trained by the U.S. Army at Fort Benning in Georgia. 11 graduates went on to be military dictators, and many others have been accused of human rights abuses. In 2000, the school changed its official name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, also referred to as WINSEC. Massachusetts Democratic Congressman James McGovern is one of the sponsors of the bill to shut it down.
And this school, infuriates people in Latin America. This is a school where many of its graduates have committed some of the worst human rights atrocities against civilian populations.
McGovern says the school is not held accountable at all. Congress can't even find out exactly who attends.
Under a Freedom of Information Act request, all we got was a piece of paper with all these black magic markers crossing out all the names.
Not all lawmakers are convinced the school is bad.
I think the School of Americas is a worthwhile international institution that we have to support, especially given the realities down there today.
Michigan Congressman Thaddeus McCotter is the influential chair of the Republican Policy Committee. He says the accusations against the school are false.
The hardcore left, like FARC and others, have always been propaganda machines. We're hearing horrible things about everything. It's part of their standard playbook. It means that we have to analyze everything objectively, and if no problem is proven, we should not let an allegation stand as an obstacle to increasing the national security of our allies and ourselves.
Joao da Silva is communications coordinator for the School of the Americas Watch. The group has tracked the training camp since 1990.
And through our research, we found that the School of the Americas, when it changed its name to WINSEC, has accepted as both as guest speakers and as students people who were accused of or signaled in human rights abuses committed in Latin America.
And Da Silva has examples, too.
There's the case of Filman Ursagaste from Bolivia, a police captain who attended WINSEC after being involved and being signaled as one of the persons involved in the kidnapping of a human rights activist, the kidnapping and torture of a human rights activist.
Other graduates include Manuel Noriega, who is currently in a Florida prison, convicted of cocaine trafficking and racketeering, and Juan Francisco Alvarado, who overthrew the Peruvian government in a military coup and then ruled as a dictator there, silencing all his opponents. The current bill's other sponsor is Georgia Democratic Congressman John Lewis. He is a long-standing human rights activist who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
We, as a nation and as a people, believe in protecting the civil and human rights of people. We do not believe in torture. We believe in freedom to worship and freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom to protest, or freedom to dissent.
Lewis says Congress needs to act in line with these beliefs.
Well, I think we could send a strong message to the citizens of the world that we're going to look in a different direction and stand up for our core values.
Whether Congress will send that message remains to be seen. Democrats have repeatedly tried to shut the school down, but have failed by slim margins. They are hoping with a Democratic majority they will finally be successful. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Auda Bogado.